Today we're diving into one of the most important health numbers you can know, blood pressure. It might be something that you feel, but when it's high, it silently puts stress on your heart, your brain, in fact, your whole body. And it's our job to make sure it's where it needs to be. To help us understand blood pressure and what we can do to keep it in the healthy range, we're joined by one of Australia's leading preventative cardiologists. Great to have you back, Dr. Ross Walker. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Lovely to be with you, Shelley.
You spent decades in the front lines of heart health, and today you're here to help us unpack the risks, I guess a lot of the myths, and some of those practical steps that we can all take on the daily to make sure that our blood pressure is where it should be. So when I say blood pressure, it's not a feeling, is it? It's a source inside the pipes.
Yeah, that's right. We need a pressure to pump blood that has oxygen around the body. So a lot of people get this wrong. It's the arteries that pump at high pressure to the tissues. So basically you carry nutrients and oxygen to your tissues through the arteries under a moderately high pressure. The veins bring the blood back to the heart under a low pressure. It's got nothing to do with your blood pressure. So the blood pressure basically is divided into two bits. What we call the systolic or the top reading, which is really the force of contraction of the heart. So whilst you're sitting there relaxed, your blood pressure should be, the top reading should be below about 120, and that's just the force of how hard your heart beats. So when you go up a hill, the blood pressure goes up, and if it doesn't, you're in trouble because you need more force to pump more blood to your muscles so you can get up the hill. When you get upset or stressed by something, your blood pressure goes up because when you're stressed, you switch on the fear, flight, fight response, which is there through and let me be a bit brutal to many people listening to this. Our bodies were only designed to work well for 30, 40 years wandering around a jungle with a spear, and then you die from trauma or infection in your 30s and 40s. Now, why this is important and why I'm saying this is that what happens is that we had this fear, flight, fight reaction that we evolved into so we could defend ourselves from an attack from an opposing tribe or some animal trying to have us as lunch. So what happens is you then flick on this fear, flight, flight response, your blood pressure goes through the roof because you're pumping blood to your muscles so you can defend yourself or run. That's what that's for. And that's why the blood pressure goes up when you are stressed. So and typically you don't feel that, but that's all the systolic blood pressure. Now, the lower one is called the diastolic blood pressure, which is the resting tone in your arteries after the heart's beaten. So the heart pumps, the heart relaxes. So the pumping is the systole, the diastole, the lower one, is the relaxing. And that pressure, as I said, normally should be 120 over 80 or less. But in fact, hunter-gatherers have blood pressures of about 100 over 60. So really that's normal blood pressure. Hardly anyone has a blood pressure of 100 over 60.
All righty. So then what happens when we get our reading and we see that one is high and one is low? Obviously, that's, as you say, the top one and the bottom one. Do they always work together, or can you have one extraordinarily high and one very, very low, or do they sort of stay in this moderate range?
That's a magnificent question. The answer to that is no, they don't always work together. But typically, if you have standard hypertension, which we'll get onto pretty soon, the systolic and diastolic go up together. So we consider any blood pressure, anything consistently above, say, 130 over 80, but even anything over 120 over 80 is higher than it should be. But sometimes, and especially in older people, so people over the age of 65, 70 who have high blood pressure, sometimes just the systolic goes up and the diastolic stays down or even goes a bit lower. And that's not a good sign either, because that's an indication of how stiff the arteries get as you get older. So it's, and really another interesting point here is that typically over the age of 50, systolic hypertension, the top reading, is more important than the bottom reading. But up to the age of 50, you'd probably focus a bit more on diastole, the lower reading, but they're still both very important. It's important to keep your blood pressure low. And as you inferred in the introduction, this is something that's done my head in for the last 20, 30 years in cardiology. We've had this extreme focus on cholesterol. And I'm not saying cholesterol isn't important, but often people say, oh, doctor, I've got my cholesterol down to 3.5 on my statin, and their blood pressure is 160 on 100, and they're about to pop a hole in their head. So you've got to really realize that hypertension, in my view, is the most important cardiovascular risk factor.
So that is the hardening of the arteries.
Yeah.
When you say when they're just not, they're not as flexible and they're not pumping the way they should.
And it gets back to what I said about the fact that we're only really designed evolutionary-wise to live 30, 40 years wandering around a jungle with a spear. Because what happens in that situation, you wake up in the morning, you pick up the spear, you wander around the jungle, you don't find an animal, so you go hungry and you just eat nuts and berries and drink water off the tree. Now, we don't do that. What do? Breakfast, lunch, dinner, and sit in our bums all day, and we wonder why we get fat. And all of that happens as a consequence of us living against our physiology. Our physiology is to live in a natural environment where we have only exposure to natural chemicals. We move all day to try and find food. And the only stress we have in that environment is the stress of avoiding the kill, or even the stress of the kill when you're trying to kill another animal and they're fighting against you. That's it. That was the only stress. But in our life, we get woken up in the morning by a thing called an alarm clock. So the alarm starts the second you wake up and continues to the second you go to bed, and many of us are not sleeping well. So all of these things are just driving up your blood pressure.
So literally, as you say, when we were wandering around with spears, our blood pressure would rise for a short period of time. Yep. It would pump hard while we're on our mission to either survive or eat, and then it would relax right down, the blood pressure would come down, and we'd sit calmly for the rest of the day. Or the fact that our blood pressure in this day and age is on the pump. Your heart is pumping hard, as you say, your arteries are pumping hard all day long because we're just in that fight or flight for hours at a time instead of a very short period of time.
And also there's another key point there. For the you go out looking for food, but sometimes the food's not there, and sometimes you walk from walking hole A to walking hole B over a day or two with minimal food, minimal fluid. So your blood pressure drops because you're getting dehydrated. So we developed mechanisms back then, 10,000 years ago, to prop up our blood pressure during those times of famine and lack of fluid. We never have those. So we're constantly being exposed by all of these factors, which we'll get to as you keep asking more questions, that are just driving up our blood pressure slowly, and we're living double our use-by date. Our use-by date is 40. And now males live to about 80, females about 84, maybe even longer. But the longer you live, the more you're exposed to all the nonsense of the modern world.
So if our arteries aren't designed to survive much past the age we are now, that's something, we've got to look after them, obviously, that is a fair game. So I guess what actually is happening, if our arteries are just getting harder and harder, they're not pumping as hard, they're not working as well, where does cholesterol, and I guess we've talked a lot with you about calcium buildup as well. So what is the difference between those two, and what do they look like they're in the arteries?
Can we just go back to the start? And the start is you're playing Trivial Pursuit and ask you a question, what's the biggest organ of the body? And you'll say, the skin. And that's the right Trivial Pursuit answer, but it's the wrong answer. The biggest organ in the body is called the endothelium, which is the single layer of cells that lines every blood vessel. And that is the protective layer, so that all the muck coming through your blood vessels, you have a big, fatty, horrible meal, and all the muck coming through the blood vessels, if you've got a good protective layer, that fat and inflammatory tissue and calcium can't get across into the wall to set up fatty plaques. So the first thing that happens in any form of heart disease is what we call endothelial dysfunction. So I'll give you a couple of examples. Within 1 hour of smoking one cigarette, are people still doing that these days, or vaping is just as bad, but within 1 hour of doing that, you knock off your endothelial function by 50%. So you lose the barrier, and you also lose the chemicals that endothelium is making to keep your arteries open and keep the flow smooth along them. If you go down to a particular takeaway food outlet that I won't mention and have one of their breakfasts, you knock off your endothelial function for 5 hours after doing that by 50%. So people don't realize what they're doing to their body. So once your endothelium doesn't work properly, it's very easy for anything like different types of cholesterol, calcium, inflammatory tissue to spill into the wall. So imagine an artery like a donut. The hole in the middle is where the blood's going, but all the action's happening in the wall. So you've got three layers. You've got the inner layer, the endothelium, the middle layer, which is the muscle layer, and the outer layer. And where the fat builds up is between the inner layer and the muscle layer. And that's what we call atherosclerosis. But here's the problem. Even if you don't have a lot of muck in your arteries, in the wall, your blood pressure can still cause a problem. The blood pressure can still increase the thickness of the arteries and make the arteries weaker as the pressure increases. So they get stiffer but weaker and more friable. So even with, say, a zero calcium score, which we've spoken about before, which is the way of measuring how much muck you've got in your arteries, you can still pop a hole in your head. It's called a cerebral hemorrhage from high blood pressure. You can still have a stroke damaging the carotid arteries or damaging the smaller arteries in the brain. You can still go into a thing called atrial fibrillation, have heart failure, damage your kidneys, damage your eyes with high blood pressure. High blood pressure is a ubiquitous, horrible condition that's very, very common, especially as you get over the age of 60. It's more the norm than the exception to have high blood pressure over the age of 60, and it's something that always needs to be treated.
Imagine this, unlocking your genetic blueprint with insights from over 200 healthy aging genes, pinpointing your unique SNPs and potential red flags, understanding what your body needs to thrive and where it may need some extra support. No more guesswork, no more random supplements, one-off blood tests, or one-size-fits-all advice. For the first time in history, we have access to the power of genetic testing, something no generation before us has had. This information could change everything. Join our free DNA webinar and you'll get our Stay Well scorecard jam-packed with the markers that we want you to track every year, starting now. Friends, know your genes, own your health. Let's learn to thrive together. Visit theagingproject.com to register and I'll see you there.
And how often should you be checking it, Ross? Obviously, you go to the doctor once every so often. They always put the little thing around your arm and check your blood pressure. Is this something we should be doing a lot more regularly and keeping note of that to see when it is rising? Obviously, again, as we get older, this is something that we must be doing, do you think?
Yeah. Look, we're now in the age of monitoring. And many people have got Apple Watches, which I've found a very useful thing over the past few years for people to have. And the Apple Watches are now even doing things like alerting you to high blood pressure. But I think it's a good thing, once you've hit about 50, to go and purchase one of those home blood pressure monitors. And I say to my patients, I'm much more interested what you'd get under your own circumstances sitting quietly at home than what I get in my office, because whether people like me or not, they're still coming to see a cardiologist. They're having their heart checked. There's a degree of anxiety around that. So
we're just finding a car park out the front of your office. That's enough to set some people off, isn't it?
All that stuff as well. But even all of that, the blood pressure they get in my office is not an indication of what it's like most of the time. So what I want to know is what they can get down to when they're relaxed. It's what I call blood pressure reserve. So I prefer them to have their own machine to check it maybe, depending on what it's like, maybe once every few days, maybe once a week, once a month. If you checked your blood pressure, Shelley, and yours was 110 over 70, well, do it again in 3 or 4 months. That doesn't worry me. But if somebody's checking their blood pressure, it's 135 over 85, that's getting up too much. So I'd like them to have to get a pattern. So I say to people, and here's the thing that I think doctors often get wrong. They say to people, I'll check your blood pressure first time in the morning. No, it's the worst time to check your blood pressure, because you go from being very asleep to awake. So that's when your blood pressure jumps up. That's when your blood's thicker. That's why I don't like people over the age of 50 jumping out of bed, putting on their exercise shoes and going for a run. I prefer people over the age of 50 to exercise in the afternoon when they've been able to re-establish a good vascular bed. So check your blood pressure, say 10 o'clock one morning, and then maybe depending on what the level was, a few days later, a few weeks later, check it at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, check it sometimes 8 or 9 o'clock at night to get a pattern throughout the day. And then to start on a pill for the rest of your life, there's got to be good justification for that, because we haven't even got to the things you can do before you need to go to pills.
Can I ask, we've often hear spoken about the little glucose monitors that you can wear, the little Vivalies that you put in your arm. And obviously, the minute you eat, you see your glucose levels spiking in that. So blood pressure doesn't actually do that. It doesn't sort of skyrocket and drop during the day.
Oh, yes, it does. Oh, yes, yeah? It does. And like, for example, I say to people, having a couple of cups of coffee a day is a health food. And I really endorse people having coffee because the evidence shows a couple of cups of coffee a day reduces your risk for gallstones, kidney stones, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, many common cancers, type 2 diabetes, depression, heart failure, and stroke just by having a couple of cups of coffee a day. So it's a good thing to do. But you check your blood pressure within a half an hour of having that coffee, it's gone up a bit because the caffeine does have a stimulatory effect, but it comes down pretty quickly and it doesn't hurt you to do that. You have six a day, you increase your risk for a heart attack by 20%. So it's all about dose as far as coffee goes. So I like people to check their blood pressure when they've been resting for 5 minutes by themselves, no one else around, no stressors, because we know stress always puts your blood pressure up acutely. So if you can't get down to, say, 120 over 80 when you're resting, you've got a blood pressure issue that probably needs to be treated.
Okay, well, let's talk about women in perimenopause, menopause, because we know the body is doing all sorts of random stuff. Yep. Our numbers are going crazy by the minute. Mm. And some days we feel great. Some days our hormones feel level. Other days we are completely out of control. Yep. How does menopause and perimenopause play into heart health?
Okay, see, I think that's a brilliant topic around this as well, because a lot of people don't realize that and this is my view of this, I'm not an expert in the field of hormones, but I still know a bit about it. I think a woman's body changes around 35, and that's why it's harder to get pregnant over the age of 35, and many women then go for IVF at that age because they're just struggling to get pregnant because their hormones are starting to change. So it's my view that there's a very long, probably about 15-year premenopausal phase where the hormones don't do that. They do, as you so beautifully described, they do this. They're going all over the shop because the ovaries are just trying to hold on and not fail. So as they fail, the hormones, sometimes you can have a whole lot of estrogen, feel wonderful, and then your estrogen drops, you feel dreadful. Progesterone goes with that as well. And so as that happens, as the hormones start to change in your body, there's a whole lot of metabolic changes as a consequence of that. So the interesting thing, the difference between men and women and heart disease is about 10 years because you guys are protected by your hormones up to menopause, then you lose that protection. And the protection comes from the balance between estrogen and progesterone. It's not just estrogen. And so as that happens, your whole metabolism changes, the arteries get stiffer, the blood pressure gets stiffer. As I say for all us men over 50, when you get over 50 and the hormones go south, everything stiffens up apart from the bit you want to. And that's just all part of the hormonal changes that happen in men and women. So around the time of menopause for women or perimenopause or even what I call premenopause, that's when you start to notice these metabolic changes in all aspects. It's not just we're talking about cholesterol or blood pressure. We're also talking about one of the key things here, which has a strong link to blood pressure, is what we call insulin resistance. Now, here's the thing. 30% of Caucasians, 50% of Asians, and close to 100% of people with darker or olive skin are born with the gene for insulin resistance. That is a survival advantage if you're a hunter-gatherer, and it's a significant survival disadvantage if you live in this society. So how do you know you're insulin resistant? You don't have blood insulin tests. They're totally useless. You know you're insulin resistant by having one of these things. Firstly, either you're pre-diabetic, diabetic. So you mentioned the glucose monitors people wear. So you sit down and have a meal and your sugar level goes through the roof. That's an indication of insulin resistance. Diabetes during pregnancy is an indication of insulin resistance, as one example. And then, so it's pre-diabetes, diabetes. Number two is high blood pressure, what we're talking about. So there's a strong link between insulin resistance and high blood pressure. Number three, you look at the cholesterol profile. Now, not the total cholesterol. There is no link between total cholesterol levels and heart disease. That is complete nonsense. It's the actual profile. So in insulin resistance, you have a high triglyceride and low HDL cholesterol. And that's an indicator that you're generating what we call small LDL cholesterol, which is a strong feature of insulin resistance. The final thing is fat around the belly. So for a male, you should have less than 95 centimeters of tape measure measured around the belly, much more important than your BMI doing this. For a female, I'm sorry, ladies, I don't make the rules, should be less than 80 centimeters. And if you're more than that, any of those features combined, you are insulin resistant, which then can set you up for all of the features of insulin resistance, such as hypertension, diabetes, significant obesity, of course, cardiovascular disease, many obesity-related cancers, fatty liver, gout, and in women, polycystic ovaries.
Over at You Must Try It, we've discovered so many fabulous low-tox skin and makeup options. Many of our guests have spoken about reducing our overall toxic load, so that has become a huge priority for me. I've slowly moved to low-tox products, and You Must Try It have made it really easy. We only stock low-tox products we've tried, tested, and love at YouMustTryIt.com. So we have done the research for you. If you haven't visited us already, please stop by at YouMustTryIt.com for 10% off your first order.
That's a lot to digest,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Because we talk a lot about insulin resistance here and the fact that it's not sort of the chub you can grab with your hands. It really is that fat that wraps around your organs, which obviously very, very close to your heart, not doing you any good at all. But those numbers, and that's fascinated me, that 90 plus centimetres for men, 80 for women, doesn't matter height, doesn't matter race, doesn't matter bone structure.
I spoke on my radio show last Sunday night about a better test than BMI, which is waist to height ratio, and that should be less than 0.5. It's a very simple test. Everyone knows their height. Get a tape measure around your belly, and it should be less than 0.5. If it's above that, you're obese. And so you don't need to know about BMIs. You see, the problem is you look at all these first grade footballers, they would be considered obese by their BMI because muscle weighs so much more than fat. Mm-hmm. So it's a useless measurement. And also as people get older, they tend to have what we call sarcopenia, which is loss of muscle mass. Mm-hmm. So they might have a low BMI but still have significant abdominal obesity, and with that visceral fat, because it's the visceral fat that's the problem. And this is why there's been this explosion of these new GLP-1 receptor agonists. Everyone's going crazy about Ozempic and Mounjaro, and these things work with the potential for a bucket of side effects. And also when you stop, the weight just claps back on. But the reason they do work is they're not just taking the fat out of your tummy, they're also taking the fat out of your organs. So people who use these drugs have about a 20 to 30% reduction in cardiovascular disease, obesity-related cancers, dementia, chronic kidney disease, arthritis because you're taking the pain off the joints. Interestingly, people who've got addictions, when they use these drugs, they don't feel like smoking as much. They don't feel like drinking as much or using illegal drugs. So there's a lot of benefits from the drugs. But as I said, they're a short-term fix to a lifelong problem. If you're born with a gene for insulin resistance, you struggle more to lose weight than somebody who's more insulin sensitive, which are the tall, skinny types that actually find it hard to put on weight.
We've got some mechanisms here that we like to recommend, one being inositol, something that you can take long-term that obviously helps your own GLP-1 system get into pace. Do you have any recommendations that you suggest to your patients?
What I say to them first is that we all eat more food than we need to. So losing weight is, and this is controlling blood pressure. So if all my patients lost 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 kilos, I'd be twiddling my thumbs all day. I'd have nothing to do. The true pandemic of the 21st century is not COVID. It is diabesity. And that's what we really need to work at. But people don't realize that it's mainly food. So a lot of fat people go to the gym. It's 80% food, 20% exercise. And I think we all need to have an exercise habit, which I believe is the second best drug on the planet after happiness. But if you want to lose weight, you've got to firstly get rid of unnecessary food. People say to me, oh, doctor, I get starving by 10:30. Get over it. I was one of the main speakers at a thing called the Wellspring Conference up in the Gold Coast last year. And I met Professor David Sinclair, who's the world anti-aging guru in Harvard. He actually grew up in the next suburb to where I'm talking at the moment. But one of the points David made at his when he presented was that hunger is actually good for you. So people think, oh, I'm hungry, I've got to have something to eat. No. Sit with the hunger, let it have an effect. You don't have to eat all the time. You don't have to fill your belly. When you look at the blue zones where they've got enormous longevity, Okinawa is one of the five blue zones in this island in Japan. They practice a thing, and for all your Japanese listeners, I apologize for my inability to speak Japanese, but they practice a thing called harihachibu, which is only eating to be 80% full. Now, I don't know if they have a foometer on their stomach and go, oh, no, I'm up to 80%, not eating anymore, but they just don't eat that much. So we have this obsession with eating food, food, food. So
we've turned it into, it's our full culture, isn't it? And it's society, and it's our social network, and it's our catch-ups, and it's our love language, it's everything.
I understand it, but the problem is we still don't have to eat that much. So get rid of unnecessary food, do not snack.
Do not go back for seconds. There's another number we need to remember.
Eat off smaller plates, and do not eat anything in a box or a container with a use-by date masquerading as food. It is not food. It is empty calories. And also what I call white death. White death is any form of sugar, white bread, and to a lesser extent, pasta, potatoes, and rice. Go straight to the gut, and also alcohol. A lot of people don't realize this, but alcohol itself is empty calories. So 1 gram of fat is 9 calories. 1 gram of carbohydrate or protein, 4 calories. 1 gram of alcohol is 9 calories. So I had a woman come to see me once, and she was quite overweight. And I said, look, you've really got to work on that weight. And she said, I don't eat much, doctor. And her husband said, no, she doesn't eat much, doctor. Then she wanted to tell me she drinks a bottle of wine a day. Now, that is 1,000 calories, even forgetting about the poison that is alcohol, 1,000 calories before you put anything in your mouth. So,
but I haven't chewed anything, so I haven't eaten anything.
No, that's
but
right.
We've certainly ingested a lot.
Yeah, that's right. So I say to people, firstly, if you want to lose weight, and this is the problem for women going through menopause, as the hormones start to change, not every woman, and this is the weird thing about anything to do with life, we're all about 99.9% identical in our genetics, but 0.1% of 3 billion base pairs in your DNA is a hell of a lot. And that's why some people respond so well to food X or exercise Y or whatever, and other people don't. And some people have a desire to do this and other people don't, because we're all different. And this, in menopause, I think about a third of women just go through menopause and don't have much of a problem with it, and they feel okay, and the body doesn't change that much. A third, they're a bit on the fence, but another third will get all sorts of problems, put on a bucket of weight, maybe get complications with HRT. And I'm a great believer in HRT, especially bioidentical hormones. I don't like pharmaceutical HRT, but bioidentical hormones I think are fine, and I think help a lot of women. But that's where when your menopause starts, and your menopause is yours, not someone else's. So you can't say, oh, my next door neighbor did this, and so therefore it's going to happen to me. That's nonsense. So that happens often in all aspects of medicine. So you look at what's working for you, work with a good integrative GP who understands perimenopausal problems. And then there are times, unfortunately, where people also need a bit of help with the things like the GLP-1 receptor agonist, the Wegovys or the Ozempics or Mounjaros, for a short period of time, just to reset their body so they can get back onto it. But realize the long-term approach has to be what I always call, we've spoken to you about it before, the 5 keys of being healthy, no addictions, good sleep, good eating, and so much less of it, 3 to 5 hours every week of exercise, and most importantly, happiness. But one thing I just wanted to say about diet, and this really does my head in, people carry on about all these fad diets like paleo and keto and all these things. The only diet that has any evidence base is the Mediterranean diet, any long-term evidence base. And that's nothing flash. And this is the problem, Shelley. Only 5% of people have 2 or 3 pieces of fruit per day, 3 to 5 servings about a half a carrot, of vegetables per day. And those who do have the lowest rates of heart disease, cancer, Alzheimer's in the community. Doesn't do zip to your cholesterol. It keeps your immune system healthy.
Much easier to reach for a carrot than it is for a glass of wine, really, for your own health, isn't it?
Yep, absolutely. And this is another thing. Again, last week on my show, I spoke about the new FDA rules where they've basically reversed the food pyramid and they're now encouraging people to have red meat. And there's been the biggest epidemiologic study in the world called the PURE study. 220,000 people in 50 different countries followed for 9 years showed that those who had the highest intake of saturated fat, meat, eggs, dairy, wait for this, had a 25% reduction in death and cardiovascular disease. So this nonsense about how you should not eat meat, you shouldn't have eggs, you shouldn't have dairy, it's just nonsense. There is no science behind it. And this is and dietitians and austere bodies in cardiology are still coming out and saying we should be avoiding saturated fat. Show me the evidence because it's just not there. Now, I'm not suggesting anyone should be swimming in red meat or swimming in milk. But again, evidence came out last week. People who have a couple of pieces of cheese a day, a hard cheese, have a around a 20% reduction in dementia. Cream, reduction in dementia. So all this garbage about saturated fat, the evidence just isn't there. It came from studies that were done on rabbits about 50 years ago, where rabbits eat a particular type of diet. And it's the same thing. You take an Eskimo and you bring them into a different scenario and take them away from all their whale blubber and fish that they eat. Their body doesn't like it because that's what they've evolved to. So if you take a rabbit and feed them a Western diet, of course they're going to get rampant atherosclerosis, give them red meat or whatever. But human beings have evolved to eat meat. You know, we kill the animal, we eat the animal straight away. There's no prehistoric Kelvinators, so we don't preserve things. We just eat it immediately. And that's how we evolved to be somewhat carnivorous. Now, if people want to be vegetarians, that's fine. No problems with being a vegetarian at all. But it's having the fruits and vegetables that are the key. But if you like a little bit of meat, eggs, dairy, chicken, fish, nuts, olive oil, there's your Mediterranean diet. That's the diet that's been shown to reduce all diseases by about 30 to 50% over time. Things like keto, paleo, all of these things, there's no good evidence of long-term effects of these diets. They might have some acute effects in certain ways, but I really support the Mediterranean diet for the vast majority of us.
Well, it's got to be easier to stick to, doesn't it? There's nothing restrictive, of course. We're just putting smaller plates in front of us and we're not going back for seconds. But have everything as long as it's lean and clean. It's simple, really.
That's exactly right. And also just the things we can do to our bodies before we go anywhere near a pill to lower our blood pressure. The number one thing I've already mentioned, get down your belly fat. So the more weight you lose off your belly, the lower your blood pressure is going to be. Number two is having an exercise habit. And here's another tragic fact, that only 25% of people have a 3 to 5 hour a week exercise habit. And even worse than that, only 10% of people over the age of 65 do 3 to 5 hours of exercise a week. And your exercise should be 2/3 cardio, 1/3 resistance training. And that's the way to keep your body healthy and keep your blood pressure low. But just having that exercise habit reduces your risk by 30%, heart disease, cancer, Alzheimer's, diabetes, 50% reduction in depression and osteoporosis, drops your blood pressure and you sleep better. There's no pharmaceutical preparation known to man comes anywhere near exercise.
Well, let's talk about some of those numbers that come in there. There's obviously your resting heart rate, your VO2 max, your HRVs. There's lots of sort of numbers and acronyms here. Do any of these play into our heart health?
No, of course they do. Of course they do. And heart rate variability is something that's been spoken about over the last 20 years or so. And basically when we're young, so if you take a child and feel their pulse while they're breathing in and out, the pulse is going up and down and up and down because they have extraordinary heart rate variability. Heart rate variability is basically the beat-to-beat difference in your heartbeat, which is an indication of how flexible and young your arteries are. If you do the heart rate variability in a very old person, they hardly have any heart rate variability at all. And in fact, their pulse is often slow and very, very steady. And it's an indication their arteries are very stiff and the electrics are very stiff. So it's not just the arteries that get stiff. The electrics in the heart that make the heart contract also get stiff. So heart rate variability, that's an important measure. Now, resting heart rate in a younger person, if you're a marathon runner, your resting heart rate is 42 beats a minute. You have an incredibly efficient heart. But if you're in your 70s with a heart rate of 42, that typically means that the electrics are starting to wear out and you may be, not will, but may be headed to a pacemaker. So that's a different issue at all. So resting heart rate is something that has to be interpreted by an expert who knows what it means for that particular person. So people, like I saw a woman last week who said, oh, doctor, I've got a Apple Watch and it tells me my heart rate drops to 39 when I'm asleep. Am I going to die? And I said, of course you're not. That's just what happens when you go to sleep. So a younger woman whose heart rate drops, that's fine. But if I have someone in their 70s or 80s who we demonstrate their heart rates can't get much above 60 and often it drops down to mid-30s, that's headed towards a pacemaker. So it's a different issue. So that's it.
Should you be trying to get your heart rate above 60 if you are 70 and 80 years old? Is it healthy to make your heart work harder?
That's what exercise does. You see, so exercise, it should be 220 minus your age is your predicted maximum heart rate. And when you're exercising, you want to get to about 60 to 70% of that. Now, I don't think people should be checking their pulse when they're exercising. It's very simple. There's a thing called perceived exertion. Now, perceived exertion is when you're exercising and you start to get a little bit sweaty, you start to feel a little bit short of breath. So the exercise is testing you. That's when you know the exercise is giving you cardiovascular benefits and contributing to dropping your blood pressure and helping you lose weight. So it's a good thing to get your heart rate up at certain times, but you don't want your heart rate when you're sitting watching TV to be sitting at 100 because the heart's working too hard inappropriately. It's all about your body working appropriately under appropriate circumstances. So it should go, your blood pressure and heart rate should go up when you're exercising. If it doesn't, you're in trouble. But it shouldn't be sitting there through the roof when you're sitting there relaxed. That's what I'm talking about. Yeah. Measure your blood pressure when you're relaxed to see that you can get down to that level. That's the key. And the final thing you asked me was VO2 max. VO2 max is something that you've got to have checked either during a stress test or there's some gizmo you put over your face and an exercise physiologist or a respiratory physician checks how much what maximum oxygen you can use when you exercise. And the fitter you are, the higher your VO2 max. And so it's a good indication, but it's a bit of a Mickey Mouse test. But it is a good indication of how fit and healthy you are.
I loved earlier in this conversation you said that men over 50 really shouldn't exercise straight out of getting out of bed and going doing weights or for thing. I've heard that about cold showers or plunges as well, ice baths and things. Is there better times of day for your heart health to be doing those sorts of things, whether it be saunas or ice baths?
Yeah, I personally believe it's better not to do things first thing in the morning. So at least have a good half an hour before you start exercising. I mean, what my routine is that every morning I wake up, I do weights and stretching, not heavy, just weights and stretching just to keep my muscle tone. But I do my half an hour on my exercise bike, which is just sitting over my left shoulder here. I do that every afternoon between usually about 3 to 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So that's the time I think people in our age group, not yours, you're a young'un, but we older farts should be exercising a bit later, only because you've allowed your vascular system to start pumping and doing its job. So you're not just anything that just goes from a standing start is not good for you. And we have a thing we call in cardiology warm-up angina, where people often get anginal chest pain, so pain in the chest when they're exerting themselves at the start of exercise, but as their artery beds open up, that they get better blood flow to the heart and the pain goes away. Now, that doesn't happen in everybody, but it is a feature. And it's a bit like just jumping into something, ice cold freezing bath is not good for you. But I'll give you an example. One of my very dear friends is a sub-Olympic swimmer and he's in his 60s now. So he almost made it to the Olympics when he was a young'un, but he still swims 4 or 5 times a week all through the year with no wetsuit at Balmoral Beach. And he's so fit because cold water swimming is one of the best things you can do for your immune system. It's very, very good. But if you're not used to doing it and you just jump into freezing cold water, I've seen one of my patients had a heart attack doing that because she wasn't used to doing this and thought, oh, I'll go in the water. It was freezing cold, jumps in and gets severe chest pain because her arteries just went into spasm. So there's always, it's like anything. marathons. But I when people say I want to run a marathon, I tell them there's a perfectly good bus service. I don't know why anyone would do it. But still, most people who run marathons will get away with it. It's probably good for them to have that level of exercise. But still, occasionally we hear of sudden death during a marathon. And that's because that particular person had a particular problem that was precipitated by the extremes of exercise. So I'm not big on extremes. You mentioned saunas. Studies out of Finland where they have a lot of saunas. Men who have three saunas a week have about a 30% reduction in heart disease by having the saunas. They didn't mention what time was the best time to do it, but I think saunas are very good for you. So it's something I condone. Any patients who want to have saunas, by all means do it.
As long as you're enjoying it. That's it. Anything that puts your body under too much stress, not a good idea.
Yeah, but again, Dave Sinclair said he's gone from living in Australia to living in Boston where it gets very, very cold. He will often walk around Boston in winter in a T-shirt because he says the cold is actually good for you. It's called hormesis. So anytime you stress the body a little bit, hunger, cold, and this is a really interesting, Shelley, that you wouldn't know this yet, but there's only three advantages of being over 50. Number one is wisdom. Number two is grandchildren. And number three, you lose the cancer risk from medical radiation. And in fact, some of the studies are suggesting if you have a bit of low-level radiation over the age of 50, it actually is quite good for you. Now, I'm not suggesting we should stand outside the Fukushima nuclear plant, but sitting in front of computers all day for a year gives you about 5 chest x-rays of radiation. Getting on a plane from Sydney to Perth is about 4 or 5 chest x-rays of radiation. So there's all this background radiation we don't even think about, and it does hurt children. I totally object, and this is happening all the time. Little kids on iPads or phones or whatever, it's not good for them. I mean, it's not good for their brain anyhow, because our brains were meant to work in 3 dimensions, and as soon as you put someone in front of a flat screen, you dumb them down and change their brain wiring. So I don't like children being exposed to flat screens. And ever since we brought in television and everything else, people have got dumber. And I just think it's because we don't read books anymore. We read Kindles, which is a flat screen. A book's 3 dimensions. So we've got to think and live in 3 dimensions. But when you've hit 50, as I said, those minor bits of background radiation we're exposed to, our physiology changes, so it's not that bad for you to be exposed to a little bit of radiation. So people say to me, oh, doctor, I don't want to have that calcium score because it's radiation, and they're 55 years old. It's not going to hurt you at all. But don't have it at 30. That's where you might have a problem.
My goodness, it's great to hear it straight from, I'm not going to call you the horse's mouth, and you say it so succinctly. It's so easy for us to understand heart health when we speak to you, Ross, and I really do appreciate the way that you're able to make it so simple for all of us. I'm at an age now where I'm hearing, you know, friends and friends of friends that are fit, healthy, strong, and suddenly just keeling over. Yep. And the shock of that. We're not talking anymore about heart attacks from overweight, obviously unhealthy people. These are, as you said before, talking about the marathon runners, the healthiest of people.
Yep.
What's going on there?
Oh, that's so easy. Let me just make the point, Shelley, that all disease is genetic, but your genes loads the gun, then your environment pulls the trigger. Now, for example, the worst calcium score I have. So the calcium score, for people who don't know, it's a CT scan, takes a picture of your arteries, measures how much muck you've got in your arteries. I believe all males at 50, all females at 60 should have a calcium score as a routine. But if your dad had a bypass at 50, you should have one at 40, the calcium score, to see what's going on. So anything above 400 is a serious score. The worst score I have is a 68-year-old man in the fitness industry, doesn't have an ounce of body fat, normal cholesterol, blood pressure, never smoked, not diabetic, no family history. So he's got no risk factors for heart disease you'd think about. But I when I saw him, I measured his lipoprotein little a, which is the cause of 1 in 5 cases of heart disease. It's pure. The only way of getting it in your bloodstream is picking the wrong relatives. It is the most common genetic cholesterol abnormality in the community. Anyhow, this guy's coronary calcium score was 8,100. His arteries were like porcelain pipes, and 12 years ago he had bypass surgery. He's one of my faithful patients, one of my favourite patients. I love him. He's a beautiful guy. He's had bypass. He's doing well. He got back to playing A-grade basketball after he finished the bypass, and he's still doing fine. But it's purely genetic. So when you hear of a 50-year-old who's done all the right things, who's had a heart attack or dropped dead during sport, there's some genetic factor that's brought this out. And had they been a profligate self-abuser, it probably would have happened 10 or 15 years earlier. That's the whole thing. So, and this is a big point that I make here, and this is about blood pressure or about any disease. Stress causes nothing, but it precipitates and aggravates everything. So I've been a doctor for 46 years. I have not seen one person in 46 years of practicing medicine who had a heart attack, stent, bypass, or a stroke who wasn't under some form of stress at the time. Now, everyone thinks, oh, stress is emotional stress. I'm going through a marriage breakup or whatever. Of course, that's stress. But that's just one aspect. That's emotional stress. Then there is mental stress. You're under the pump at work. You've got deadlines. That can do it. Then there's physical stress. One example, I had a 78-year-old man thought it was a good idea on a 45 degrees Celsius day to play singles tennis, ended up with a stent in his arteries, as one example. But it's not just the physical stress of exercise. It's the physical stress of exercising during extremes of heat or cold, as we've mentioned. Air pollution. A lot of people don't realize air pollution is associated with 1 in 6 deaths around the world these days. And it precipitates the problem if you've got the genetic issue. Then there is pharmacologic stress. I had a guy in his 30s with a strong family history of heart disease, went out in a Bucks night one night, had a few lines of coke, wiped out half his heart from the cocaine. And it's not just cocaine. People foolishly believe that marijuana is healthy. Medical cannabis is fine, totally different. But smoking high levels of THC, within 2 hours of smoking one joint, you increase your risk for a heart attack 5 times. And during the COVID pandemic, the final stress is infective stress. So you're going along fine, then you get an infection that can then inflame a plaque in your arteries, rupture the plaque, cause a heart attack. So genes loads the gun, environment pulls the trigger.
So is your calcium score then, is that something you can change? Is that something you can help? Obviously knowing it is one thing, but doing something about it, is it still just the lifestyle factors that we've spoken about today that obviously are the way that we should be living?
No, it's much more than that. It's what I call 80-10-10. 80% of anyone's management are practicing those 5 keys. And so don't come in to see me with a big fat gut or a fag hanging out of your mouth and thinking that any pills are going to help you at all. So everyone has to keep their lifestyle tight, which is 4 times more powerful than anything a damn doctor can suggest. We're not that powerful. Mm-hmm. Lifestyle is. Lifestyle is king. And Shelley, there's a little known place in America called Harvard. And Harvard have been doing for the last 85 years a thing called the Grant Study. And the Grant Study shows beyond a doubt the one key to health and happiness is to have someone else in your life who loves and cares for you, who you love and care for, much more important than your damn cholesterol level or your blood pressure. So that the most selfish thing anyone can do for their health is to love their partner. There is no doubt. It doesn't have to be your romantic partner. It might be your child or it might be your parent or whatever. But to have that love, to experience that love with people is much more important than all the other nonsense we go on about. And so those 5 keys, 80%. 10% is the appropriate use of medications, which we haven't even spoken about for blood pressure yet. And the other 10% is the appropriate use of evidence-based supplements. And I have a strong association with many companies who make supplements. I do a lot of research for them. I'm on the scientific advisory board for a number of different companies because I believe in supplements. Most of my colleagues don't. But I can give you strong science behind how they work and how they support the medication. So I think that supplements keep healthy people healthier, and they make the drugs work better if you need to be on drugs. And that's how I see it. So with blood pressure, the 5 things you can do, which is a bit like the 5 keys of being healthy, lose weight, as I said, off your belly, exercise, avoid sugar and salt like the plague, because sugar and salt are so bad for your blood pressure. Number 4, keep your grog down. And number 5, manage stress as much as you can in this crazy world we're living in. They're the 5 natural things
again
you can do. Sorry?
Again, you do make it sound so simple, and it really is. We can look for all the excuses in the world, but you lay it out so clearly for us, Ross. Let's talk supplements.
Yeah, sure. So all right. The supplements for blood pressure that have an evidence base, the probably the best one is Kyolic Garlic. And I have no associations with any companies that make Kyolic Garlic, but two Kyolic Garlic capsules in the morning can drop your blood pressure probably similar to a simple blood pressure pill. So I, with all my patients, I put them onto this before I start the pharmaceuticals. And if people are listening to me, I'm not against pharmaceuticals at all, but I see them as the last resort. Not the, you don't walk into the doctor and immediately, oh, take this pill. My cholesterol's high, doctor. Oh, take this pill. No. Have a calcium score, look at your lifestyle, and then reevaluate. But you don't want to be on these pills for the rest of your days if you can avoid them. The second supplement that has a great evidence base, and again, because this is a public forum, I must say, firstly, I do all the research with the Italians on this particular stuff. It's a bergamot product that comes from Calabrian oranges, bergamot oranges grown on the southern Ionic strip of Calabria. And the nutrient in this is called BJE 100. I can't mention the product, but one of those twice a day also helps lower the blood pressure. Now, most people will love this next one, Shelley. A couple of pieces of dark chocolate greater than 70% cocoa has been shown to lower your blood pressure a bit, improve blood flow. It's a terrific thing to do to have a couple of pieces of dark chocolate a day and a few other things that help. Ubiquinol, I'm on the scientific advisory board for the company that makes Ubiquinol, which is a component of many supplement companies in Australia make a Ubiquinol, so I'm not particularly picking on one product. Ubiquinol has a weak effect on lowering blood pressure and different forms of magnesium. My favourite magnesium is magnesium orotate aspartate. And things like pomegranate and beetroot juice, very good for blood pressure as well. And then finally, if you've done all these things and you don't have bad sleep apnea, because sleep apnea also drives up your blood pressure, and all adult males have a degree of sleep apnea, which most women would know after their partner's had a night on the grog. So the snoring and the feeling dreadful the next day, that drives up your blood pressure if you've got bad sleep apnea. But one question that I can ask everyone, which will tell me whether they need their sleep apnea investigated and treated, when you wake up in the morning after what you believe to be a reasonable night's sleep, do you feel refreshed or unrefreshed? If you're waking unrefreshed consistently, you probably have either sleep apnea or another sleep disorder. That needs to be sorted out. Once you sort that out, down will come your blood pressure. But after that, it's medications, and we have a whole lot of very effective medications to control blood pressure.
We're going to have listeners here that are on blood pressure medication now. And of course, these conversations are always just a starting point for people to ask some more questions, think a bit more broadly. For anyone who is questioning why they're on these medications or what they can do about it, Ross, what do you suggest?
Oh, look, firstly, to reassure people, high blood pressure therapy has been proven over 30, 40 years to be very safe. And I have no issues at all with people being on blood pressure. The issue I have is people not looking after themselves and then taking the blood pressure pills thinking that's going to be the panacea. The panacea is how you look after yourself. But always when you're on medications, if you feel any new side effects, always ask your doctor about that and say, look, I've been on this pill for a while and I feel for example, there's a very commonly used blood pressure pill called an ACE inhibitor. So people who know these drugs, Covercil, Tritase, those sort of drugs, 10% of people who take that get a dry cough. And often they'll start on the pill and within a few months they're all the time. And they don't even associate that with the pill. So any new side effect or issue, always ask your doctor about it. So, and it's a bit like last week a study came out saying that statin side effects, the drugs to lower cholesterol, are so overdone. I don't agree with it. I think the study's wrong. I believe that people have a lot of subtle side effects with these drugs they don't even think about. And as soon as they stop, the side effects go away. So, again, you've got to balance the risk of the disease versus the inconvenience of the treatment. But the important thing about all of this, I think everyone needs to have a good relationship with a trusted doctor who they feel they can talk to. They won't be judged. I mean, a lot of doctors, you'll go and say, oh, doctor, I'm taking this supplement. Oh, that's rubbish. All that'll do is give you expensive urine. It might give you expensive urine, but it also gives you very valuable blood that'll keep you healthy. But the doctor will deride you and make you feel like an idiot for taking something that I generally believe I take buckets of supplements every day, but I only see it as 10% of my management. The 80%, the five keys.
Ross, GLP-1s, and I'm not going to call them a fad because I think they are here to stay, but I do want to obviously alert our audience to how that could be affecting your heart health. Yep. We know that long-term, they're not a great option. They might help you lose that 10 kilos, and of course, for anyone who has been prescribed it medically, absolutely speak to your professionals about that. But this idea of they're just going to help me get across the line to the body that I want, we know they've got lots of wonderful health benefits, but how does that work long-term and how does it affect your heart?
Well, see, the problem is the studies on the GLP-1 receptor agonists have only been around for 3 years. And so we don't know what's going to happen to people after they've had 10, 15, 20 years of these drugs. So they just haven't been there. And this is my concern, that the more unnatural a product is, the greater the potential for problems. And so there is no doubt that in the short term, GLP-1 receptor agonists do help a significant proportion of people lose weight. And the worst thing for you is to be overweight. It's not taking a drug, it's being overweight. So that diabetes is something that we really need to harness. And GLP-1 receptor agonists are one answer to that, the greatest answer being changing what you put in your mouth and changing how much activity you do. That's much more important. But the evidence is showing, again, over about a 2 or 3 year period, around a 20 to 30% reduction in all forms of cardiovascular disease in people who use GLP-1 receptor agonists. So they are very good for the heart because, and I don't wish to sound indelicate here, but if you do an autopsy on an obese person who's died, half their heart is full of fat. So what the GLP-1s do is take the fat out of the heart. Now, I think that's horrendous when you think about it, because we weren't designed to be fat. We were designed to wander around that jungle with a spear and not carry a lot of fat. And so that we had these storage sites around our tummy for the time to, we kill the beast, eat it straight away, store a bit of fat in the belly for the next big feed 2 or 3 days later. Breakfast, lunch, dinner, sitting our bums all day, we get fat. So the GLP-1 receptor agonists are working on a very important pathway that regulates appetite, regulates metabolism, regulates entry of sugar into the cells, and that they are doing a good job in that way, but they're pharmaceutical drugs. And what we are finding, for example, that there is a much higher rate of pancreatitis, so they can really inflame the pancreas in a small proportion of people. The risk of pancreatitis is about 0.1%, but it's still 9 times higher than the average population. There's also a risk if you've got a family history of thyroid cancer. There's a risk for increasing your risk for thyroid cancer. It can really delay the emptying of food out of your stomach. So just say you had a shot of your Ozempic on the Monday morning and 3 days later you had to have emergency surgery, you can still have food in your stomach that can aspirate down into your lungs. And also the big thing is the weight gain that as soon as you stop. So I say to people who are going onto any of these drugs, and it should be done obviously with supervision of your doctors, when you've achieved your target weight loss, say, well, I've downed the 15 kilos, I can stop now. No. What you then do, instead of having a weekly injection, you have a fortnightly injection for 3 months, then a monthly injection for 3 months to allow the stuff to wean slowly out of your body, because otherwise you'll get that rebound weight gain. It's a bit like when you're on a statin. If you started off with a cholesterol of 6, the statin drops you down to 4. If you stopped your statin at 4, for the next 6 months, your cholesterol goes up to 8. There's always this rebound. Your body rebounds. It does the same thing with the GLP-1 receptor agonist. So, yes, there are a potential for significant side effects, and probably about 40% of people who take GLP-1s get a degree of nausea with it, and they certainly lose their appetite, which is part of how it works. But there are problems, and it's like anything. With all pharmaceutical drugs, you've always got to weigh up the benefits versus the risks. Same thing with statins, blood pressure pills. The benefits are enormous. The risks are incredibly low.
And you've given us those today's, Ross. We've got a lot to work on, and I know every time I talk to you, I pick up a lot more, and I do know how to then help myself clean up my act a little bit, and it's wonderful to have these reminders with you on the regular basis. So thank you very, very much for talking to us today. We'll get to it. and keep our hearts healthy, get our numbers right, get our blood pressure down, and of course, take into the five keys that Dr. Ross speaks highly of all the time when we get the opportunity to chat to him. So we thank you very, very much. Get your plan, stay clean, stay healthy. We'll speak to you soon.
As always, the Aging Project podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes. Always seek medical advice from a qualified practitioner.